Well, here we are.
It is time, Simba.
If you understand that reference, you might be about the age where we should be working together. It's possible. But it is now one of 3 times a year that I'm accepting clients for my freedom framework, overcoming food sensitivities and increasing energy without unnecessary restriction. My goal for my one-on-one clients is to take them through frameworks and explore tools for achieving 50, 80, 90% of their goals in just a few months and show them how to continue to heal on their own so they don't need me anymore. Honestly, I think we're doing great one-on-one work here, helping women that would otherwise be falling through the cracks, thinking that they're just aging, that they're just moms, that they just, and it may be true that they just have stress, when really those stress hormones and their other core systems just really need some serious support and some serious love to serve them for years to come without symptoms. So if you'd like to clear inflammation, eczema, food sensitivities, or improve energy and brain clarity, I'd love to chat with you. You can book a call with me at kristabigler.com/FSS, kristabigler.com/FSS, and that link will be in the show notes. Welcome to The Less Stressed Life. My name's Krista Bigler, your host, and if you're here, I bet we have a few things in common. We're both in pursuit of a less stressed life, but we don't have it all figured out quite yet. We're moms that want the best for our families, health practitioners that want the best for our clients, and women that just want to feel better with every birthday. We're health savvy, but we want to learn something new each day, and the less stressed life isn't a destination. It's a pursuit, a journey, if you will. On this show, we're going to talk about health from the physical, emotional, and nutritional angles, and want you to know that you always have options. We're here to help you heal yourself. Welcome to The Less Stressed Life. And on this episode, we're talking today about optimizing fertility. In this episode, I'm going to cover the 3 hormone systems to optimize for an easier pregnancy or easier fertility, nutrition support that optimizes both energy and pregnancy, and maybe even considerations for miscarriage prevention. Now, earlier this week, I actually did this as a live Zoom community Q&A call. I've been experimenting with those since about last fall, and so I'll include some of that Q&A at the end. But first, I have a story about today's sponsor. 8 years ago, my husband lost his health insurance and I was self-employed. I'd been working in conventional care up to that point in my career, and I was seeing gross mismanagement of the healthcare industry daily. The company I worked for was amazing, but the reasons we were treating the patients were completely preventable, and our small facility created about $1 million per month in healthcare system burden due to these mostly preventable diseases. My nurse friends also shared stories with me of people faking chest pain for an ambulance ride just to get cigarettes. I did not want to be part of this broken model, and it weighed heavily on my heart. While frantically searching for options to my healthcare dilemma, I found Christian Healthcare Ministries, or CHM, which would allow me to submit medical bills for cost sharing and reimbursement. CHM is a member-based nonprofit ministry, and it's shared 100% of eligible medical bills for members since 1981. I've been a CHM member over 8 years, and I love that it provides a healthcare solution for my entire family that's budget-friendly while also sharing the same values that include prevention and healing. I know where my healthcare dollars are going and who they are supporting, and I even have the option for maternity cost sharing. With the money that I've saved being a CHM member over the years, I've also been able to allocate our healthcare dollars where they matter most to my family. If you want to learn more about whether CHM could be a solution for you, there's a link in the show notes for getting more information, or you can go to chministries.org/less-stressed-life. That's chministries.org/less-stressed-life. When you use that link, it really helps them know if you heard it on the podcast. And I hope that my story is helpful to you in case you are in need of a healthcare solution. Okay, so first of all, fertility is a pretty big topic, and I'm going to scratch the surface today. I'm going to talk about it from mostly a nutritional angle, and I'm going to cover just a couple things about structure and other things. I won't really be covering major things conventional testing-wise, or if you were going to a fertility clinic, I'll be covering some different things than what they would be covering, and I'm not going to cover cycle tracking. Once upon a time, when I had interviewed someone about migraines, I remember her talking about the treatment pie, and I think you really have to think about this from a treatment pie perspective as well. On the Q&A yesterday, someone was asking questions that were essentially like, how do you prioritize? And I will say there's some skill to that, but you can kind of write out the pieces, or as you go through this episode, maybe take some notes because it'll help bring out some things. And I would say always start with the easiest things first. So big picture, there are stressors that come in and affect our body and our ability to do things naturally. That's like the crux of what I do in private practice. So some of those stressors might involve imbalances in digestion. That's going to impact nutrient digestion and absorption. That is going to affect detoxification because detoxification is very nutrient dependent. It's also going to impact progesterone production because stressors and nutrient deficiencies impact progesterone. And I'll just mention progesterone and sluggish thyroid are some of the biggest reasons I see fertility issues in practice. It's also going to impact thyroid production, which I just said, which stress and nutrients also impact that, just like they do progesterone. And then we also have these other issues where testing is variable. Maybe some people have different testing tools in their toolbox and others have different ones, or the analysis of testing is an issue. So these are all some possible barriers you might run into. Big picture, fertility. Fertility is really about more than conception. It's about health and vitality. That shouldn't be depressing. It's just we sometimes refer to it as the fifth vital sign. There's a book called The Fifth Vital Sign. So once you address structural things, anatomical things, and infections, like sometimes a subclinical kidney infection that you're not having a lot of symptoms for, but it can show up, especially in men. Once those types of things are ruled out in fertility, we really want to look at these other tenets or core pieces of fertility that include toxic burden, mitochondrial production, digestive and immune function, and inflammation and oxidative stress. Now, that's a pretty big comprehensive topic. So I'm going to zoom in to these hormone systems and then the particular hormones that I see causing issues in fertility the most. So the three hormone systems that impact fertility include the ovarian hormones, the adrenal hormones, and the thyroid hormones. You can also refer to this as the OAT axis, ovarian, adrenal, and thyroid hormones. Now, ovarian hormones are usually the ones we think the most about. And I think each of these can have a personification. So progesterone is kind of like the really happy hormone. Most people want more progesterone. A lot of people don't have enough progesterone. Progesterone and estrogen can act like a teeter-totter, and if estrogen is in excess, not getting cleared, broken down as well as it should be, there's a lot of places it can get in a traffic jam, then progesterone may suffer and kind of be on the lower end while estrogen kind of dominates on the higher end. That's not always the case, but it can be a common situation, so I'll just want to put that there. So estrogen often gets a bad rap, but it really is more of a Jekyll and Hyde situation. Estrogen is necessary as a growth hormone, and not having enough estrogen looks like I just had this conversation with someone today who took too much estrogen detox supplements, that you can end up with dryness down there. So poor lubrication, you can have hot flashes. These are symptoms of perimenopause and menopause. So we don't want to be eliminating all of our estrogen. We should have a healthy level. But sometimes when you have too much, you might associate it with negative symptoms that a lot of people have experienced before, most commonly felt before your cycle, and maybe even before ovulation, because around those times is when your body is clearing out estrogen. So those symptoms might look like mood changes, might look like tender breasts. It might be that you have a really heavy period because as a growth hormone, estrogen is predicting kind of the width or the thickness of the lining, the uterine lining that's shedding. And so if it's growing more, then you're going to have a thicker, heavier period. It's also maybe going to be associated with things like fibroids, etc. But it's a Jekyll and a Hyde. You need it, but you need to be able to clear it. And there's a lot of things that happen with your digestive function and different phases of liver detox that can make kind of estrogen jam up, even in lifestyle. So if you have an issue with a COMT gene, then caffeine and stress will block estrogen from exiting. So there's a lot of pieces there. So progesterone, happy hormone. You have the most progesterone typically during pregnancy. So if you've ever heard someone say that they were the happiest or the best they ever felt was during pregnancy, it's probably because they live in a low progesterone state the rest of the time. Also, progesterone naturally declines postpartum and could be a piece of postpartum depression. So progesterone is our happy hormone. Estrogen, kind of Jekyll and Hyde. We need it, but we need to be able to clear it. And then we have testosterone. And these are all of these ovarian hormones. Now, there is a little bit of testosterone made by the adrenals, but primarily it is made from the ovaries. Testosterone, I always call the maintenance man. If you don't have them, you're not going to have very good muscle repair or tissue healing, and you might just feel like total poop if your testosterone is very, very low, which commonly has been from long-term stresses or traumas. But if testosterone is high, you might find that really annoying also. So again, maintenance man, you need him around, but you don't need him a ton. So too much testosterone can look like chin hairs, hairs around the nipples, the belly button, etc. Let's move on to the adrenal hormones. I'd like to state that I think if the adrenals feel like they're under duress, that none of the other hormones really care. And let's just go to adrenals 101. The adrenals make several hormones, aldosterone, impacts blood pressure, DHEA controls blood sugar, and if you don't have any, you might feel really hangry or shaky, even going a couple hours without food. But really, adrenals are kind of known for their cortisol production. Now, cortisol is an essential hormone. That means all other hormone production is going to be downregulated so the body can make cortisol. So resources are often taken away from the central area of the body, and preferentially, blood is moved to the arms and the legs to literally run from a tiger or to go do that stressful thing. The problem is that, of course, we live in too much chronic stress or fight or flight. So cortisol can be a little bit like a speedometer. When you're speeding, you speed. You use up a lot of gas, and then you're out of gas, and then the adrenals are not really functioning and not producing hormones at robust levels. And your brain has a ton to do with this. Your brain kind of communicates overall to everything else, no matter what. And so if the brain senses an issue, and that could be literally a head injury, a concussion, if your brain senses any kind of anything that's a stressor, it is possible it may impact your hormone production in the ovaries and the adrenals and even the thyroid. So that's the third system of hormones, thyroid hormone. Now, I really have come to love this topic because I was a sluggish. I am my clients, right? So I had very poor, I had run out of gas with the adrenals. I had sluggish thyroid that did not show up on blood work. So when you feel not good, but your labs say you're normal. And I do have ways that I assess this in practice, which is nice, but I think we have an epidemic of kind of low hormone status or sluggish thyroid. And so those symptoms can present long before the labs are altered. And I just want you to know you do have some options there. There's a lot of nutrient support, honestly, stress support. I noticed the most that I had more thyroid symptoms when my stress was higher. So some of the most common thyroid symptoms would be a lot of hair loss, feeling very cold or especially cold extremities, hands and feet. So I would see both of those things with more stress. And then some of the other ones could be like tired or brain fog. I think sometimes brain fog is considered a term of weakness. And so we don't always think about it. But, you know, just think about whether if you forget what you're doing, you know, if you walk into one room and you kind of forget, that would be brain fog. Or I also kind of liken ADHD symptoms to this a little bit. So feeling a little bit scatterbrained. I really thought I had ADHD before I started supporting my thyroid. Some other things that you can have, which it's kind of hard to put your finger on this one, but it can kind of make your face puffy or just kind of make you feel a little more, I guess, inflamed or a little more puffy. And some other symptoms that can be symptoms of thyroid or other things as well would be predisposition to dry skin, dry hair, even dry feet. And you also have an increased predisposition to anxiety, depression. So I know what you're thinking. Woof, that's a big list. I might be all of those things. I get it. Like, I think you have to be supporting the thyroid all the time. And I think if the adrenals are in tough shape, then the thyroid may not function beautifully. So let's talk a little bit about cortisol. A lot of these things I'm going to say are more like tendencies, and I'll try to make this brief. So if you have high cortisol, that's that fight or flight. So you're kind of like always rushing from thing to thing to thing, feeling pretty constantly agitated or irritable, maybe forgetting to eat, right? That's going to raise your cortisol because your body needs that blood sugar to try to stay kind of more consistent. So just like not taking breaks, feeling inflamed, feeling like things are out of balance, thriving on deadlines and stress. Those are all the things that kind of, those are the lifestyle things that really lead to kind of elevated cortisol. And then low cortisol might be looking like, usually it's going to be a low nutrient profile. So it might be slow healing. Like maybe you get acne or a mosquito bite and it's just very slow recovery, or you have slow recovery from workouts, or you just kind of feel dead after doing cardio, makes you feel worse. craving salty foods, having kind of a predisposition to being dizzy from sitting to standing, from laying down to sitting up, maybe always registering on the lower end of the blood pressure. All of those are pretty classical low cortisol things. And unfortunately, these are not that, this section is not really recognized. You're not going to go to the doctor and say, I feel this way. And they're usually not going to diagnose you as having an adrenal issue. I think a lot of people walk around feeling like this and aren't really sure how to support themselves, honestly. And it's very nutrient dependent. It's really nourishing. It's resting. It's lots of things. You can't just out-supplement lifestyle. And this is where people really get into trouble because they'll add a lot of support but not change how the stress is metabolizing in their body, which honestly is beyond the scope of this conversation for today, which is okay. They just mean that there's a lot of options and there's a lot of ways to go about it. There's not a wrong. Well, there's just many ways to do the same thing. All right, let's go to sex hormones. So excess estrogen, I talked a little bit about that already. So it's like PMS symptoms, painful heavy periods, bloating, headaches, migraine around ovulation and period, especially breast tenderness, fibroids, and then low estrogen. I brought this up as well. And usually you're going to see lower hormone from a history of undereating, being under body weight, not having enough cholesterol. So cholesterol gets vilified unnecessarily. Cholesterol is a steroid hormone backbone to making the rest of the hormones. So you need adequate cholesterol. So let's stop giving medals for low cholesterol. That's actually I hope that dies soon because that is very archaic. So low estrogen, normally we would see this more in perimenopause and in menopause when your body is like checking out of the fertility era, right? And it's checking into the post-fertility era of perimenopause and menopause. But this might look like hot flashes. It might look like fatigue, depression, might look like joint pain, muscle aches, dry skin, vaginal dryness, sleep issues, etc. So not very fun stuff. But if you're a younger woman experiencing low hormone, you can have this happen just because of, you know, not having the pieces, the cholesterol backbone to make hormones, and then just overall under eating. So especially if you've been an athlete in earlier life, I see that kind of stuff happen a lot. All right. I think we talked a little bit already about elevated and low testosterone. I mean, elevated testosterone is going to be a predisposition to acne and oily skin. Facial hair that, you know, pops up really chest, nipples, belly button, et cetera, kind of darkening of the armpits, maybe hair loss in the wrong place, maybe PCOS diagnosis. That's a whole nother topic for another day because sometimes that can get a little bit sort of misdiagnosed and it's not high testosterone necessarily. And then low testosterone, also anxiety, depression. Isn't that fun? So many reasons for that are possible, increased belly fat, et cetera. Okay. So I don't know if you needed all of that, but big picture, I like to think about, well, what influences hormones? What if we don't just spot treat, but we support the how you water the tree and you trim the tree and you give it sun? I'm like more of a fan of that. So here's the things that hormones are impacted by or influenced by: stressors of all types, toxic burden, detoxification burden, gut imbalances or gut stressors. So that might be bacterial imbalances and fungal overgrowth, parasitic infections, blood sugar, right? So that can be just spikes in blood sugar, skipping meal. It can be all kinds of things, right? Just depending on how, just depending on all kinds of factors, and the nutrient deficiencies, right? So if we have gut stressors or toxic burden stressors, those are really going to impact nutrient deficiencies. And then if you don't have nutrients, there's just so much to say about nutrient deficiencies that parade around as other symptoms or even other diagnoses. It is a bother to me. So the core values really of fertility are blood sugar balance, detox, digestive health. When you do those things, you're really influencing egg and sperm and then cervical mucus fluid quality, because you need that cervical mucus to get the sperm to the egg. So it's going to travel a long way. And then implantation and embryo development, that can be impacted a lot by membrane. So whatever we do to like improve regular cells or phospholipids and membranes may impact fertility well. So all of these things are going to impact pregnancy outcomes in different capacities. So I hope I remember to also mention, I'm just going to insert it here really quickly in case I forget later, because it's not in my notes. There is an omega-3 testing company in my state. They do a nice little blood spot finger prick, and I learned from their PhD RD that if your omega-3 status is adequate during pregnancy, then there's no known benefit to add high quality omega-3s and DHA. But if you are not having, if you do not have adequate omega-3s during pregnancy, you're at an increased risk for early preterm birth, which can be very, very expensive because preterm birth may land a baby in the NICU, which can be a very expensive thing, and not to mention really challenging on the mom, right? Because she's missing out on that bonding time, just a lot of trauma and stressors. And sometimes things happen anyway, but I kind of wish when we're talking about all these public health initiatives, and if we have research that supports this, it's just an area that I wish was just a little bit more readily accessible and available. So you can test your omega-3 status, and your liver can convert plant-based omega-3s, ALA, into animal-based omega-3s, EPA and DHA. But if you're like me and you have a sluggish gene, your liver does not convert that very well, then I'm going to be depleted if I'm not eating salmon or black cod or maybe algae as the only plant-based version to get that EPA, DHA. So just nice to know information. You can test this. You can take it. Take a high quality product. Don't be buying trash, because that's where any negative research probably comes from with fatty acids, is that they're oxidized. So you need to have a high quality product with that has stable omegas. So fertility has many angles. So we've been talking here and there about the nutritional angle, but there's also a structural angle and an emotional angle. So I interweave stress into the conversation in general, and I'm going to get into more nutrition specifics here in a moment. But before I go there, I want to just mention an episode that's coming out soon that talks about some other structural pieces of fertility. So I interviewed a physical therapist recently, and she was telling me about something called Mercier therapy, which was just developed by a PT with the same last name. And essentially, I interpret it as some abdominal interventions every week for 6 weeks. And one of the mechanisms is that it brings blood flow to that area. So earlier, we were talking about with high cortisol times, blood flow literally leaves that area and goes to the arms and the legs. And without blood flow in that area, that could impact hormone production as well. So by bringing back, by nourishing, by supporting blood flow to that area, you may improve hormone production, which is just a cool, different way to go about it, right? I'm talking about it mainly from a nutritional aspect, but there's just so many cool opportunities for you to support fertility that don't have to be so invasive or even like tens of thousands of dollars. That's maybe unnecessary. So before we get into egg quality, let's talk a little bit about male health. So obviously, reproductive health is dependent on both male and female. Sperm can be influenced up to a few months in advance. It's more straightforward than the female reproductive system. And this is a stat from my friend Ayla's presentation, but the American Society of Reproductive Medicine estimates that 40% of infertility cases are from the male partner contribution. So here are some things to be assessed for male fertility. That includes semen analysis and ruling out infections like kidney infections, evaluating stress, evaluating oxidative stress that can be impacted by a lot of alcohol or cannabis use, or just anything else that causes oxidative stress, like poor sleep, just life things, smoking. Those things can all add up free radical damage and take from antioxidants, because the main thing with men is antioxidants for supporting their sperm. So heavy, heavy duty antioxidants. With females, it is antioxidants and mitochondrial support for the most part. So egg quality, we're thinking about supporting the egg. We're thinking about supporting the egg like the cell membranes. And something that's kind of cool that comes up in fertility conversations is that you were inside of your grandmother, right? So your grandmother housed your own mother, and inside of your mother was her eggs. So, you know, your grandmother's nutrition influenced you. So I'm thankful for my grandmother. And I also feel like I should be a good steward of my body for my grandchildren's health, right? So men regenerate their sperm, but we have our eggs forever, and they have been around for a while. So with egg quality, it's also influenced a few months in advance, and mitochondrial nutrients include, but are not limited to, CoQ10, alpha lipoic acid, and acetylcysteine. And then there's a little overlap here between the things that are also antioxidants, vitamin E, vitamin C, and then even myo-inositol, which is actually kind of considered more of a B vitamin and can help with blood sugar regulation. Now, I use a fair bit of vitamin E when I'm starting out to support clients. I might use 400 IUs of some mixed tocopherols, although Dr. Barry Tan, in his episode about vitamin E, made some pretty compelling arguments for tocotrienols, and I have been using those a lot as well. Either which way, high-quality vitamin E, 400 IUs is good, can help support and mimic progesterone. CoQ10 is always pretty awesome for energy, and honestly, I might just turn around and take some today since it's the first day of my menstrual cycle, which is my little hack for functioning on the day of your menstrual cycle, which is your lowest energy day of the month typically. So whatever supports cellular energy is going to support egg quality. So mitochondrial support and CoQ10 is probably the most well studied. So all of those things are supportive. And that's like I would consider frosting. You always want to make sure the foundations are done first. But I'm already working on foundations when I work one-on-one with clients. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the fancy stuff. So in addition to egg quality, I'm also definitely looking for subclinical signs and symptoms of subclinical thyroid. So maybe not showing up on blood work, but how can we support it with nutrients, nutrient cofactors largely. And then I'm also looking for signs and symptoms of low progesterone. If you resonate with symptoms of high estrogen, there's a good probability you might have lower progesterone. It's just kind of an obvious thing. You can also ask. You can ask for your full thyroid panel to be tested. It does not mean it's perfect at all. You can ask for your progesterone to be tested. You can ask for things. But just keep in mind, our body's last priority is fertility. So our resources for that are just going to be turned down when other inflammation stressors are on the body. I have written, you know, the body keeps score, the brain's really in charge. So the longer I've been in practice, I realize like the brain is really in charge more than anything else. So a couple other things. I understand from really friends and colleagues that often I think the standard of care is that a further workup or further hormonal workup, often people come in and they're like, well, I had blood testing. I'm like, well, find out what you're having done. Because sometimes it's like $2 or $3 worth of blood testing. It's just really not anything. So you can get extra things done. As I said a moment ago, you can ask for comprehensive thyroid testing. You don't always get it. You can ask for progesterone testing. That should be a little more straightforward. There's, you know, not as many markers there, right? You can order testing on your own. You can learn and you can advocate for yourself, or you can find an adjunct provider, you know, outside of your fertility provider, outside of your OB, if you want some additional support around that. I do some of this. I don't really advertise this because it's not my main thing, but it's always fun when someone comes in and says, fertility is also on my list of things I would like. So I really enjoy that. But you have lots of options and some resources I want to guide you to. There's a few books. One, Laura Bryden's Period Repair Manual for a Cycling Woman. I wouldn't just be turned off by the name if you don't feel like your period needs repairing. I also think we have low expectations around our menstrual cycles and it's been normalized to have negative symptoms, which I think is unreasonable. But what I love about this book in paper format or like the actual hard copy format is it's really a reference manual. So if you're like, man, how do I improve my progesterone? I mean, she gives honest answers and nutrients and different things to support that. So I think it's a really beautiful resource for that. My friend Lacey Dunn wrote a book called The Women's Guide to Hormonal Harmony. It's very generous. It's the first edition and some of the charts are like a little bit small, but otherwise it's a very generous book. She does a great job of covering just tons of topics. And then Lisa Henderson Jack, she's the host of Fertility Friday. She also wrote The Fifth Vital Sign when you're really trying to think. That's if more thinking about optimizing cycles and optimizing for fertility. So I mentioned earlier about omega-3s and preterm birth, and I want to mention also that N-acetylcysteine has been shown to potentially help with miscarriage prevention. So you, again, have options. And now I am going to cut over to some of the Q&A from this week's live Q&A. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on optimizing fertility. Jennifer says, can you speak to secondary infertility? Can a first pregnancy change hormones significantly? Jennifer, do you want to unmute and give me more context so I'm not trying to guess? Because I have a tendency to try to guess context sometimes. But long story short, of course, everything can change, right? So if you want to unmute and share anything.
Yeah, sure. I can So I have a son who's four, mm-hmm. and we've been trying for about a year to conceive again, with just no luck. So I've only just begun like getting tests from doctors and stuff to see, and scans to see if there's any physically thing wrong. But I'm just wondering, like, can the impact of a first pregnancy shift your hormones significantly? Like, I haven't experienced any changes really, mm-hmm. aside from maybe in the first like 12 months postpartum, but other than that, everything seems like it was pre-first pregnancy in terms of cycle and all that sort of stuff. So I'm just not sure how you, if that has impact or how you assess that.
Oh, yeah. So first of all, anything can change at any time. Second of all, here are some questions I would ask you, and you're welcome to answer or not answer, depending on what you want to do. So it's like, okay, do we have any trouble getting pregnant the first time that we knew of, right? That would be the first question. Second question is, what happened postpartum? Did you, was it tough? Did you crash at all? Did you have any stuff going on postpartum that kind of sucked? Because all of that can just lend to maybe my progesterone's not robust. Right? Maybe the stressors, because if you have stressors, you're not going to have optimal thyroid function potentially, right? And so that kind of stuff can impact fertility pretty significantly. Anything like stressors can come in at any time and start to cause an issue, right? Like you can have some new gut issue come in and create some imbalances. I don't think this is a good one, but I don't know anything about you. So I don't know how old you are. One major thing is like, okay, so if you were 37 first pregnancy and now you're 41, I'm just making this up, right? Or like you're 39 first pregnancy and 44 in the second pregnancy, your body might be downshifting some hormones, but I wouldn't go to that first. But I just want to say, like, obviously in mid 40s, sometimes your body will start to downshift some hormones. But before that, we would expect, and then you also would look at like your mom when she started experiencing those things. That's not my first stop. It's just kind of like you do a good questionnaire history. And again, you would go like those symptoms that I put up there for all those different things. If you screenshot that, like, do you resonate with any of those symptom patterns? Those would be some questions to ask.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, I mean, I do with some, but I find it always hard to assess, mm-hmm. like what's normal and what's not, and how bad does it have to be in order to tick the box? You know, it's, mm-hmm. I find those mm-hmm. things difficult, but
yes,
so that's helpful.
Yeah, and I think you know sometimes it's hard to see the label on the bottle if you're inside the bottle, so sometimes it's good to potentially work with someone if it's been a while and if your timeline is more urgent or whatever, because it's working with having someone who knows how to put the pieces together is just going to be a shortcut as usual. So I always like to start with symptom assessment, or if you want, you can dive into one of those book resources. But I guess I encourage you not to like, if you experience that symptom at all in that month, I would just check it, right? Because things ebb and flow. And I think better to like write that down and start to look for those patterns earlier on. So it's hard for me as someone who like really like one of my favorite things is pattern recognition. honestly, it's like my favorite thing. Everyone's sending me a direct message. I hope it's okay if I just say this out loud. Lindsay, thanks for sharing this. I'm 35 and 18 months into our conception. MRI indicated possible structure issues. So I had laparoscopic myomectomy. Means we get a break until October before trying again. So you have a good time then to like support egg and sperm quality, right? That's an opportunity or other things that you can do. All of the hormone specimen and blood work we did came back into normal. So the first thing I would say to that is get your blood work and have that, right? Because someone else may not view it as normal, or they might view it. So the thing about conventional testing is that the reference ranges are based on the most, the more like that recent patient population. So these reference ranges are getting like honestly worse and worse sometimes. So it's good to just know. Sometimes people say, well, I went and had blood tests and came back normal. Well, there was like $3 of blood tests done, you know? So I'm sure that was more, but it's just this whole conversation gets more complicated because people are like, oh, I tested my thyroid. I'm like, yeah, you probably tested two markers out of like five or six, right? So, and I don't even really think blood testing is like a very gold standard, unfortunately. But this is just me because I have other tools that I think do a better job for subclinical thyroid in addition to symptoms. So just opinions. There's room at the table for all opinions, actually. And that's okay. because there's more than one way to do everything. All of hormones, specimen, and blood work, we did come back as normal. So you just want to make sure you get those copies and look for anything that's trending high or low next to the reference range. So I'm thinking about these next 4 months as a great opportunity to optimize every other factor I can, which is perfect. Given the standard OBGYN fertility test docs I've already done, lack of symptoms outside of infertility, is it worth it to seek additional testing or just relax? Ooh, that's a good question. Should I seek additional testing or relax? Well, I think in general, do anything you can for your brain and for your nervous system. You will always have leaps and bounds better life if you support your brain and your nervous system. So whatever you think, and then it's up to you what you do. Like, I think it's you decide what kind of capacity do I have, right? Like I can't, some stranger on the internet can't tell you what capacity you have. So you have to decide, where is my energy here? How much do I have to put into this? What do I want to do? Have I checked? So my question is like, how's your progesterone? How's your thyroid, right? When you say all of your blood work stuff, like, was that even appropriately assessed? Because those are really the first things I'm kind of looking for in symptom history is how's that thyroid working? Let's look at the symptoms and how is that progesterone looking, right? So, and like, what's your, I don't know, like Lindsay, for example, like how's your menstrual cycle? Because that can give you some indication.
That's a funny thing. Did you want me to answer? I'm so sorry.
Please.
Yeah.
Okay. So much less weird super, than to talk to myself.
I would say super, super regular. And only in the last year and a half did it change and to get a little bit heavier in those clots, which the doctor attributed to that fibroid that was removed. So I don't know yet if it was effective in kind of changing that. But regardless of kind of those symptoms, it's always been super regular, not very painful or exciting, and not a ton of symptoms around it.
Well, what do fibroids mean? You know, they mean potentially some estrogen excess and maybe some detox issues. You have not had a previous child. This is your first?
Correct.
All right, cool. So probably estrogen, progesterone balance, there's some opportunity there because there was a structural change from a physiological amount of something. That's what I'm hearing from that. There was something else you said. And I thought you said, did you say it had gotten heavier? There was something else you said around that.
Just the amount and like size of clots and things.
Oh yeah. Okay. So blood clots or more clotty periods has to do with poor fatty acid status or poor omega-3 status. So you can dose this huge problem. People like halfway dose things like as if it's going to make a difference. People like take 500 milligrams of omega-3s instead of 4,000 like they should because it's like very expensive to take 4,000 of high quality omega-3s, not from Sam's Club or Costco. Let's not do that. Okay. It's like if we have to name a brand, let's pick Nordic Naturals, right? It's going to be not the cheapest, but it's going to be much better. You can literally take like 3,000 to 5,000. Actually, in my state, there's a company called, if you want to like validate this further, Omega Quant, you can do a blood. Now they do a good blood spot test. This was developed at a university. They have an antioxidant on the page that preserves this from getting like oxidized and the test being ruined. So this company, you can do a like $50 if you want, you don't have to do this, but you can do an omega-3 basic test for about $50. You do a blood spot. They tell you it's extremely straightforward. They tell you like where you're at with your omega-3 index. Why is this important in fertility? If your so big picture, inflammation uses up your fatty acid status or omega-3 status, omega-3 and 9. We have inflammation in our life, duh, like stresses or inflammation. So we have inflammation. Your body will either convert plant-based fatty acids into animal-based fatty acids via your liver, or if you're like me, your genetics suck at that. So I have to, like, if I'm not taking in salmon or algae, I'm not getting my omega-3. So if you're not eating salmon, black cod, algae, pretty much your only food-based sources of animal-based or EPA, DHA, you're probably low in this. So really the answer for clotty periods is to take omega-3. So you can just see where your base is. If you want to test first, it's very accessible to you to do at home. Or you don't have to just take enough omega-3s to actually see a difference, a minimum of 3,000, in my opinion, like not less than that, and then see your clots potentially disappear. So you do have some inflammation as evidenced by clots. And you know, it doesn't have to look like your grandpa's inflammation. You know, it can look like straight up plain Jane. I got clotty periods. Guess what? Not normal. Sign and symptom, the end. So like, there's a lot you can tell from just a little bit of like case history, which is why I prefer talking through like individual cases, because it's like, well, I can learn, you just can learn so much from like symptoms if you put them all together. So for sure, you're probably deficient in omega-3s. And why is this important when you get into pregnancy? If you're deficient in omega-3s, you should be dosing omega-3s during pregnancy. It's massively related to preterm birth, not to give anyone stress around it, but how cool you could like avoid a NICU stay by having adequate omega-3s during your pregnancy. Carolyn said, what could be potential things to look for light periods, like 1 to 2 days long and help support so it's more normal? That would be low hormone in general. That is going to be low estrogen and low progesterone. Remember, estrogen is a growth hormone. So I'll get to why this has in a moment. Estrogen is a growth hormone. And so it's going to predict how thick that lining, that uterine lining is that will shed. So if you don't have a very thick lining, then you might have low hormone. That's the most likely cause because it's not making a very thick lining to shed. So you have a very light period. The most common reason for low hormone in general, like across the board, low progesterone, low cortisol, or low progesterone and low estrogen, especially low estrogen, is under eating, low body weight, low cholesterol. Those are the big ones. The question would also stand to be, did you ever have absence of period as well?
No, I never had any absence of period. My cycles aren't super regular, but I would say like within the last year, they're like the longest was around 38 days. And then the shortest cycle was 30 days.
How old are you?
I am 28.
Okay.
And what I else? Did get some hormone testing done. I've had like multiple rounds of blood labs done, and my last round for estrogen, it was 130. And then for progesterone, it was, I believe it was 8. My cortisol was a little bit lower. It was around 6. So I didn't know if the cortisol, if that played a role.
It sounds like that's the, so big picture. First of all, do you have your labs in front of you?
I can pull them up.
Yeah, go ahead and pull them up. So big picture, your cortisol has a curve. So I'm guessing they checked it in the morning, spot checked it. When do you think they checked it?
Yep. It was around 9 or 9:30 in the morning. And I believe I'd been up since 6.
Okay. So kind of a ways, but usually it's going to peak 30 to 60 minutes after you wake up. So it would have peaked at about 6:30, 7 or something like that. And then after that, it's still going to be pretty high. So it's just a spot check. Usually you should check a 4-point, but from what I know about, if the reference range is what I'm thinking it is in my head, that's pretty low end of range. Does that sound right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if your cortisol is low, common problem, right? You might have massive adrenal stuff that needs a lot of love and support, a lot of mitochondrial support, a lot of mineral support, et cetera. And so that means like, you maybe ran out of gas potentially. It's just a possibility, right? So if you run out of gas, your body is like, I can barely make cortisol. Like, why would I care about making progesterone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you have the reference range for the progesterone? So the progesterone reference ranges are going to depend on the time of the month because it varies where you are in your cycle. So if you have the reference range for where that point of the month was, you can share that with us. We can talk through it.
Yeah. It was post-ovulation and I confirmed it. I tracked my temperatures and it looks like I did have a spike in my temperature.
Mm-hmm. So what was the reference range for that time
frame? On the blood work, it says for the luteal phase, 1.8 to 23.9.
Okay. And then your estrogen reference range was what?
43 to 211.
So you said your estrogen, what I wrote down, I think I wrote down 180 or 130. I can't read my writing.
130.
Thank you. 130. And then for the progesterone, the 8. So it's kind of like not crazy low, but it's on the lower third of that reference range, right?
Right.
So it may not be awesome. I think probably, is the cortisol, was the reference range like 6 or 7 to something?
Let me see. Said cortisol in the morning, the reference range was 6.2 to 19.
Yeah. So like and barely there. I would say focus on loving your adrenals because your sex hormones don't really care if your adrenals are shot. That's what it sounds like is going on, is your adrenals are in not amazingly resilient shape, right? Does that sound like it to you too?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
thinking. Just wanted to double check and get your opinion on it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about you, but I see this like constantly all day long. So it's just like happens. So just love, love the heck out of those. And it's a bit of a long game. You gotta, there's a lot to like, there's a bunch of nourishment stuff, but it's like more sleep than you think you need. Really good blood sugar, like eating enough, often enough, et cetera. Like there's a bunch of pieces to that, but there's just a lot of things you can do to like nourish and support it. You can't, it's all about like pouring into yourself essentially for that. And it makes sense. I would have expected that with low, or a light cycle. It's just like not robust hormones. So
Cool. All right. Thank you.
Good. Yeah.